From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Rapper Emmanuel Jal was carrying a gun, an AK-47, at the age of 8. He was a child soldier in the Sudan People's Liberation Army. During the famine and civil war, he was one of the thousands of children who walked across Sudan and Ethiopia looking for a safe place. He was conscripted in Ethiopia and taught to fight. Now he's a music star in Africa and a rising international star. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Emmanuel Jal and talk with him about his transformation. His new CD is called Ceasefire. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings from the Pablo Casals Festival in Prague, recorded in the 1950s and long out of print or unavailable. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest survived the famine in Sudan, survived traveling on foot back and forth between Sudan and Ethiopia looking for a safe place, and survived being a child soldier in Sudan's civil war. Emmanuel Jal was conscripted by the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLA, the southern militia fighting the government of Sudan. Jal was given a gun to fire when he was 8. He was saved from this life by a British aid worker, the late Emma McCune. A movie is being made about her life, starring Nicole Kidman. As for Jal, he's now an international rap star living in Kenya, where many Sudanese refugees live. He's just made his first CD released in America. It's called Ceasefire. Rapping on alternate tracks is Abdul Gadir Salim, a Muslim musician from the north of Sudan. Jal is Christian and from the south. Jal raps in several of the languages spoken in Sudan, as well as in English. This track, Gwa, is a new recording of his first hit single in Kenya. Just hold on a minute, think for a minute. Give a little confused salam, and again, and a salu, salu. For a kabir, I confuse Sudan. When my people will plant seed in the land, when my people will be free in the land, when my people, that's why. Yeah, I can't wait for that day when I see no more tears, no more fear, no pride, no tribalism, nepotism, and racism in my motherland. I can't wait for that day when the wonderful people go back home and plant their nation in this generation. I can't wait to see that day. That's Emmanuel Jal from his CD, Ceasefire. Emmanuel Jal, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before we talk about music, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your story, a really amazing story. So if it's okay with you, let's go back to when you were 4, when the civil war broke out in Sudan. How many years after the start of the civil war did you actually leave for Ethiopia?
Okay, what happened? The war broke up 83, and then my dad was a policeman. Then also my mom was working as a nurse and as a teacher at the same time. And it was insecure, so his friends used to be assassinated at night or killed if you're suspected to be supporting the SPLA. So what happened was my dad left and he joined the SPLA, so I was left with my mom, so there was no enough stuff, food, like, and everything. So we joined, that was 85, that's when we joined my dad, and I was taken from my home, 87, to go to Ethiopia. So
when you say you were taken from your home, were you given any choice? I mean, who were the people from the SPLA who came to take the orphans and the children who no longer had homes?
There were no schools in the south, so in the villages, people just take care of cows, and that's life. There's nothing to do, no schools. So the SPLA suggested that the children should be taken to school. So in all the part where the SPLA had control, so children were collected. And also it was a good thing. People were giving out their children and they're saying they're going to school and at least they'll be in a safer place because it was promising taking them to schools and they'll be better people.
So your mother was okay with this?
My mother died 87 there.
So she died before you left?
Yeah, she died before I left, yeah. She died like few months, and then after few months, we're collected.
So how far was the walk to Ethiopia?
I don't know how many miles it was, but we walked long distance. Took us like 2 months to reach there.
Were there adults with you to lead you and to protect you?
Yeah, there were few adults, few people with guns, but because we are many, it was not easy like to control all of us. On the way, sometime at night, the wild animals will take advantage and snatch someone and disappear in the bush. So we face places where we lose people on the way. And it was much safer to travel at night than in the day sometimes because of the planes that drop bombs.
Who was bombing you?
The government of Sudan.
The government that the SPLA was opposing?
Yeah, yeah.
How big was the group that you were traveling with?
Okay, but to be honest, that time I didn't know numbers.
Right. Interesting point.
So I didn't know how to count proper, so I just say people. So, but now if I see a number, I can approximate.
So what would you approximate now, looking back?
From my group, were hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
But when we accumulated into Ethiopia, it turned into thousands.
After getting to Ethiopia, you were expecting to go to school, and I guess you did go to school for a while, but then you were recruited into the SPLA army as a child soldier. You were, what, about eight or something?
Yeah. Actually, what happened was most of us volunteered to be trained because it was better than to be forced to. But one reason was...
Wait, was that your choice, is volunteer or be forced to do it?
Yeah, if you're forced, it would be bad. So it's rather you volunteer. But the main force was the bitterness that many young people had in their heart, because you come from a village where you see your house burned and some of them lost their parents. And then because you are told the story, when you ask who did this, then you'll be told it's the government of Sudan who did this. So every young person was willing to fight because of they wanted to revenge. And yeah, and they are told this is our land. It's being snatched from us. So every person has to play a part in the struggle. So every kid was down for it.
Okay, so you were around eight. What were you trained to do in the army?
Okay, we learned how to operate the guns, yeah?
Which guns?
Learn how, AK-47. Then we learn how to cook for ourselves food. We learn how to build our own houses. Then we learn how to attack a town and how to make ambush, how to run if the war is hot, how to fall back. People died in the training. Sometimes we learn how to eat hot food in few minutes. Then we have less time of sleep, maybe 3 hours of sleep, and then sometime you're waking up unexpectedly. So we're learning how to live life of bigger people. It was hard, but few of us managed.
Were there certain kind of missions that the SPLA sent the children to do?
Basically, they would pick the bigger ones. They're the ones that were taken like from 11, 12, if you have a bit of muscle. So they would come and pick them. And later they tell them we're taking them to a different school, which is far from here. So the school that you're being taken, you get surprised in a front line. So that's what used to happen sometimes.
Whether they'd say they were taking you to school, but you'd end up in the front line?
Like what happened is we're in schools, so someone would come and say, we need the people of this age. If you're not of this age, you'll not come. So they'll take from age 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 there. So they say, we are taking you to a different school of your age mates. So the ones that are left don't have knowledge of where those people have gone to. So when they've gone to a farther place, which is not a school, but they'll go and get dressed in uniform now and fight.
What were some of the typical missions that the SPLA sent you to do?
It's just attack a town and weakening the defense system of the government, because young people don't know you die at once. So sometimes they're brave, but when they really get scared, they're really scared. It's hard to convince them to fight.
Were you ever so scared you wouldn't fight?
Sometimes, you know, before shooting, I would feel like going to toilet many times to urinate. Before you fire, you're really scared, nervous. But after you fire the gun, you become okay. And it pulls you, it makes you scream and you want to even run inside the fire. But sometimes, I never knew, like, people used to die once and they go. So it's just like the way kids play here with toy guns. It's toy. But then now we're using the real guns and young people are excited to fight.
You said most of the children in the SPLA didn't really understand the meaning of their own death. But what about the meaning of other people's deaths? I mean, you were carrying guns, you were killing other people. What did it mean to you when you were...
The training that we're given, it kind of kills feelings, you know? You don't miss people. Like, I never missed people from my home. You feel nothing. It's like we don't have feelings, so you just obey commands. And that's all. So it's like we're like kind of robots in a way. So it's just like the way people are in the army, you know. And then when someone die, because you still think young, you don't know they've gone for good. But after some time, that's when you realize this person is gone. Oh, it's really, he's dead, you know. Now that's when I used to feel after someone. After a while, but if someone died 3 days, I don't feel it. But after a while, then, oh, this person is gone. And because there was no that friendship attachment and all that, it's hard to find that love, you know, in the army. You know, people are just hard. Everyone wants to show that hardness.
My guest is Emmanuel Jal. He was a child soldier during Sudan's famine and civil war. Now he's an international rap star. His new CD, Ceasefire, is his first to be released in the U.S. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Emmanuel Jal. He was a child soldier in Sudan's civil war. Now he lives in Kenya and is a rising international rap star. His new CD, Ceasefire, is his first to be released in the U.S. You grew up in war, and that's all you knew was war. You never really knew peace, because you were four by the time the civil war broke out. And, you know, when you're 18 and you're in an official army, you've had a chance to develop a conscience, a sense of right and wrong. When you're a child, you haven't had that chance yet. And so here you are having to shoot people and being shot at yourself without the benefit of an adult's sense of what's right and what's wrong, or, you know, of a fully formed conscience, you know, an understanding of what's right and what's wrong.
It was because of what many of us have seen. We understood, even me at a lower age, I was 5, 6, and I was in the cities where the government were, and I would see how the black are treated bad and how they are treated like slaves. If you are a black person, you are meant to be working for the Arabs, you know? So you work for them. And as a kid, I don't understand why things like this. So most of us come from that background, so they know that's why they had that bitterness to fight. And it's hard to find any ex-child soldier from SPLA to actually say SPLA is bad, because it was the thing that we're seeing, like fighting for our freedom for all of us.
No, I've read about some countries in which there are child soldiers, in which the children are truly exploited. And the children are considered the most expendable of the troops, and they're sent. They're basically just used. Everyone knows they're going to die. Their lives are cheap. No one really cares. Did you feel like you were treated with more care and respect by the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army?
Yeah, sort of. The only thing I knew is they never gave us drugs. We were given proper food. And if we go to fight, it wasn't often. It was maybe to weaken the defense system. Then the other army will come and fight, because they're also thinking twice. And they actually took others to school, like maybe to Cuba and many other places, because they're also thinking, if we wipe this generation out fully, then we may be out. But because there was another pressure, they still had to use us as well.
Did you assume that you were going to die young?
I used to pray. So my mom inspired me, and before she died, because I used to see her praying, she's telling us, there's somebody called God there, so if you ask him, he'll protect you. So I used to pray if this before war, with this helicopters coming or gunship coming to throw bombs, I used to believe like God is there and he's going to protect me. So I had so much belief. So I never thought that I'll die.
And you're Christian?
Yeah, I'm a Christian. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm from Muslim background, but we later changed to be Christians.
After traveling on foot from your home in Sudan to Ethiopia, where then you started fighting for the Sudan People's Liberation Army, you eventually walked back to Sudan as one of hundreds or thousands, you can tell me which, of boys doing the same thing. Was this journey on foot any easier or more difficult than the one to Ethiopia?
It was more difficult because now you have ammunition and you have a gun. And, yeah, and sometime you could be ambushed. There are minefields, some places. It wasn't easy. It was terrible because there was pressure, guns, fight. You're walking to Sudan and the enemy is chasing you. So when you're tired or what, if you're about to relax, they still catch up with you. So you fight, then you learn to move back with tactics.
So you had all the problems of hunger and thirst, plus you're being attacked all the time.
Yeah, so it was an escape. But with tactic now, you just don't run desperately. So you run in a way that the enemy knows they don't have to run after you so hard because you're armed. So you run to maybe after a few miles, you try to make a defense, fight with them a bit, and then running again, things like those, until we crossed the river where they were not able to come across, because that was the border.
Now, I've read that during this period there was so little food that some of the boys would eat flesh of dead bodies.
When SPLA had its own crisis, so I think there's no point. I can't fight. We can't fight each other. So when my knowledge was growing, then I was saying, what's the point? There's no common enemy. We're fighting each other. So I said, let me go home to where my dad is and try to live in the village at least. I want to go and protect the family back at home there. But the journey ended up being terrible. So that's where I was forced in occasion where like almost to eat a dead body.
So when you're almost forced to eat a dead body, what goes through your mind when you're deciding, do I do this or not?
I was thinking, like, what about if I survive? What am I going to do when there are people there? I've eaten someone. Does it mean I'm going to be eating people? Because if there's no food, then because I've eaten somebody and survived, so I'll end up snatching children and eating them. So such things. Then I said, God, if you're there, just give me something to eat because I don't want to eat someone. So, and the prayer seemed like it worked. A bird came, and then I ate that bird. So I sang, oh, it worked.
What is it?
A bird, a crow.
Oh, okay.
I was depending first on snails, snakes, vultures, and then wild animals, others.
But some of the boys you knew did eat the flesh of the dead.
Some ate, you know, like when you relax, you're in a different tree, other people are in another tree. So that it, and when we later met different group, different place, those who ate never survived. Any person who ate a human being that time, they never survived. But the few that survived went and died from trauma, because when we got rescued, there's proper food. So they just become mad and they just die. They're crazy because they remember the images eating human being, and so they just go crazy. Some would just commit suicide.
Emmanuel Jal will be back in the second half of the show. His new CD is called Ceasefire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Bob and Melinda Blanchard's Live What You Love, Notes from an Unusual Life, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, from Bantam Books, publisher of A Briefer History of Time, an updated and revised edition by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow, available in hardcover. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rap star and former Sudanese child soldier Emmanuel Jal tells us how the British aid worker Emma McCune transformed his life. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews some long out-of-print Pablo Casals recordings from the 1950s. Nyama shwala nyambol sheman dial chikalujen jen me man kana gwan chilu shana nga gwan ngwalende kola sheng na dor gwalende jen la yaya na shang beling ba jonya mbol wo kwertong nyangul lelme kanyambul lelme na shang yak jen nyambul cha da kuyo der ngulel na shang la falen shang tie ko ko gwan dong der ngalwa anta nyambul kuyo der ngulel anta nyamun jen yak jen ba do nyambul yen yok nyambul akwa nyambul lelme na shang ne man nyambul jen yong maung tun tun no boroda ngar jen This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Emmanuel Jal. He was a child soldier fighting with the Sudan People's Liberation Army, the SPLA, during the civil war and famine. Now he's an international rap star living in Kenya. His new CD, Ceasefire, is his first to be released in the U.S. Here's another track from it. Kalamsa, Elijah be the God you gulen daja asel chana kun saw.
ena shialing ka tuk shi nya dam damari kanyumari kishin kwari enjene de la riento ya salam doran en sha confus tane kwa dia chana riang tema dene par enjen shialar ka tuk shi nya dam macharo palpen dene wedan dene tas kadene shara wido kong shiana
When we left off, Emmanuel Jal was talking about how he survived near starvation and other hardships, walking from Ethiopia to Sudan, trying to return to his village. Eventually, you met an aid worker, Emma McCune, whose story has been told in two books and is about to be told in a movie, and Nicole Kidman is going to play her. She met you, she took you under her wing, she took care of you, she basically adopted you. And smuggled you into Kenya, where you were able to actually live a more normal life and get an education. How did you meet her?
What happened was there was an American friend of her called Kristen. So Kristen was the first one I met, and told Emma, like, there's this kid. So both of them were fighting over me. One of them, Christine, wanted to take me to America. How she wanted to take me. So they were fighting over me. But later, Emma managed to convince Christine that let me take the boy. So then I don't know why they chose me. There are many other boys, but I ended up being chosen. So she's the one who... That's how it happened. But she came late and realized, like, she's actually my cousin because she married my uncle.
What was it like for you to actually have an adult who wanted to protect you? An adult who didn't want to send you into war, but wanted to send you to a safe place and protect you?
It's always been in my heart that, like, I want to go to school. So someone here is telling me I'll take you to school. So I just said, cool. I was disarmed, and everyone there supported it. So then they said, if you take him to school, then he's going to be a better person. And he'll come, because in Sudan people believe if someone has gone and they have the knowledge, then they'll be able to help the people better. So it's like they've seen the light. So I was so happy. But life wasn't easy where I went to, because I am from a childhood that is just violent fighting. So people around me would suffer trying to control me, because I was fighting all the time. Taken to school, I'd fight in class. So I was violent everywhere. But I changed within time.
Tell me more about what you were like then. Did you have any social skills? Did you know how to talk to people? Were you honest? Were you trustworthy?
I was kind of naughty, you know, very naughty. Like, people would remember me well, because sometimes I didn't remember how I used to do things. Like, I never had any table manner, nothing. So if I'm eating in a place, maybe a chicken, I'd just eat it after I finish, throw it on the floor, whether it's a carpet or no, I had no idea. So then you see people who had cats, like Emma, they had cats, so I would kick them out of the house, chasing them. Why are you keeping animals? They're supposed to stay in the bush, you know, and dogs. So people, I used to cause a lot of trouble. But it took me time to adapt, live a life where, with feelings, you know, where you feel for people and show them affection and love them, yeah. It took me time.
How do you learn to feel affection and love when you've been deprived of it for so long? And not only that, when you've been taught to just kill. I mean, how does something like love re-enter your life? How do you learn to feel again?
It's just like the way people just concern about you. They are not even, you don't know why. They give you nice things. They take you out. They smile with you. You talk badly with them, but they still respond positively. So you just wonder, why are they doing this? What are they trying to do with me? Why are they like this? So questions like those we're asking. Ask yourself, why is this white woman trying to take me all around? Why is she doing all these things? Can she get her own child with us? So with time, when I understand the love she had for me, then it humbled me like to change and try to respond, because I'm thinking, damn, this person is doing too much. So those are the things that bothered me. She comes, I've done terrible thing, maybe I've fought with someone, so she's cold, or maybe I've broken someone thing, or done talk badly to someone. So the concern that she had was the effect that it gave me, how to adopt, and I began to develop feeling for people and trying to talk to people positive and nice.
But Emma McCune, the aid worker who adopted you, she died, a couple of years later? And then after actually starting to feel something for her, and after she helped you so much, she was gone. So what did that do to your ability to continue to grow emotionally?
Yeah, I was like becoming more human. She died. I said, what? She's dead? How? So I said, you mean she's not going to be there anymore? She's gone. To me, when someone die, I don't respond like that. So if someone die, I feel nothing. But here, someone is dead. I was asking a lot of questions, many questions. And I didn't know. But there were people around me that tried to talk to me, like Emma's brothers came and Emma's friends. And my uncle was there, so they would talk to me, and I understood. And I say, this is life. People come, they'll show you love, they'll be with you, but sometime they have to go. Yeah, but it took me time to, like, understand it fully. She's gone.
My guest is Emmanuel Jal. He was a child soldier during Sudan's famine and civil war. Now he's an international rap star. His new CD, Ceasefire, is his first to be released in the U.S. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Emmanuel Jal. He was a child soldier in Sudan's civil war. Now he lives in Kenya and is a rising international rap star. His new CD, Ceasefire, is his first released in the U.S. When you returned to your village in Sudan, looking for family and wanting to protect your family, who did you think would be left? Your mother had died. Your father was fighting with the SPLA. What and who did you expect to find?
Relatives, so my brothers and sisters. Yeah, those are the people I wanted to find.
What are your brothers and sisters doing now? Did they survive?
One of them managed to track me. She walked from Khartoum to Ethiopia, came back to Sudan, then met some people who told her, we know your brother is a famous singer in Kenya. So they gave her a free lift on a plane. They smuggled her and brought her direct to where I was. And she sang with me a song, the song Gua. I sang it with my sister, actually. But the rest, I'm yet to find them as I stabilize myself with time.
You've gone from being one of the lost boys of Sudan to being a music star in Africa. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about music. Let's start with how it entered your life. I don't imagine you were hearing a lot of music when you were a child soldier fighting with the Sudan People's Liberation Army. Like, when did you start to actually hear contemporary music? Because the music you're doing now is a form of hip-hop.
What happened is I explored my talent at the age of 20. That's when I started. Because I was not in school sometimes. Sometimes I'm in school. So I found like, oh, now I can't afford to go to school. I can't do anything. What do I have? What can I do? And, you know, so sometimes, you know, the only community level that was ready to take care of people was the churches, you know. the singing in the church was so beautiful. You know, in Africa, the way they sing in the church, it's awesome. You just go there, it's like you're having a free concert mm-hmm. with positive messages, and then you walk home happy. So, and most of the time they were talking about God and all that. So I said, this God helped me when I was suffering. So why can't I write for him some songs? Then I wrote songs dedicated to God. And then we used to make concerts and in schools and churches to raise funds for ex-child soldiers to go to school with some communities there which helped them, and also for the street children. So with time, it happened.
Okay, so you started off singing in church, and you fell in love with music from the church. How did you hear hip-hop?
Basically, you know, like, hip-hop, it has a lot of relation in Africa. Like, the style I'm singing has no different with the way men sing at home. So the difference is that we don't have beats recording it, you know. Mostly at home, like... Yeah, people just use drums and they can't. Sometimes you don't need beats, you just use sticks and beat the stick and make a song and you just chant and people listen to you. So, and then someone told me, the way Americans are singing, they're just modifying what they've taken from Africa. So someone was telling me, even your grandfather was chanting, so you're not wrong, because I never wanted to do hip-hop. Then I said, wow. So when I did research, I remembered how people back when I was a kid used to chant and do this. I said, cool. So I'm hip-hop, let me just do it. So I just said, okay, I'll chant like this. Then I'll get the chorus done this way. Then now we add the music. So I would go to a studio and then give them the sound that I want it to sound like. So they just grabs the idea, then they put the way I want my music sound.
Well, you're rapping about things like peace, and a lot of rap music in America is about drugs and sex. I guess you won't be chanting about that in your music. Or will you?
Not really, because like, what I've come from, my past is terrible. Then, because I know many young people are suffering down there, and they need hope. They need to see good things happening. So, like, my heart is poured down to them and see what I can do best. And like, if I just sing about women, and there are some of them who just look up to sing what I'm doing, you know, because they like my music, it may force them to start thinking about women. And so I want to pass messages of hope into the music that can strengthen people and not to give up their dream, because I was hopeless, I was homeless, you know, things like those. And I've been a refugee for 25 years, 19 years, as depending on aid, you know, things like those, just to show something that people, like, it's possible. If you have a dream, you can still achieve it if you hold it.
I know you performed this summer in the Live 8 conference, and you were among the few African performers in this concert, a concert to raise awareness of poverty and starvation in Africa. But although you performed in England, but you weren't on the main stage. You were on a stage in Cornwall that had a much smaller audience that wasn't, I don't think it was televised. How did you feel about performing in a concert for Africa, being one of the few African performers, yet not being part of the main event?
I met Bob Geldof and I asked him, how come someone like me is not on the Live Aid, the main stage at Hyde Park? What he told me was, if you haven't sold 4 million copies of CDs, you can't come to the Hyde Park. So I said, I was just beginning, I haven't sold 4 million copies of CDs. So then he said, if I were to come and perform at Hyde Park, the Chinese would switch off the TV And I said, why? It's because you're not famous. And I said, okay, all right. So the whole world would switch off their TV because a coming up African is performing. So he said himself is not going to perform because he hasn't sold 4 million copies of CDs. But later when I found out other people didn't even sell 4 million copies of CDs and they performed at Hyde Park, himself he performed. But when I heard everything that he was saying, it kind of, he lost his respect that I had for him. Although he has done good things, I just managed like to forgive him, like, no man is perfect. You could try to do something, but there'll be an error somewhere. But I felt marginalized. But I said, anyway, it's okay, this is music business. But with time, people will hear what I have to offer.
I'd like to end with the opening track from your CD, Ceasefire. And I'd like you to talk about what this lyric is about.
Haiwa, it's in Arabic, it's in English, it's Kiswahili, and Nuer. It has four languages in it. And the thing is talking about how we can use love. If we give love a chance to work within us, then we are able to live and not to just kill each other all the time. And we can share everything we have and enjoy the land together. An example is like being just the way a white woman will marry a black man. The love doesn't know the color, it crosses boundaries. So we give love a chance, then that the tribalism, the racism, all these things, they'll all die out. So and then the girls just respond, "Haiwa," you know, "Haiwa, Haiwa," things like that.
Well, Emmanuel Jal, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, sure. You're welcome.
Emmanuel Jal is a former Sudanese child soldier who is now a rapper living in Kenya. His new CD, Ceasefire, is his first to be released in the U.S. Humalin the island way, maybe could have come con. Then a quad, the island, and done palpin. Then a new, and then a little down the looker. Lay me all alone and then go now.
Back to the east way, it sound like a mystery. If you got love, you got the victory. And then go to the Larnanade now. Come with you all know, a very important. We TV, every screen, a bad news everywhere. Thumo Gamato, being a Nagnaro Dian everywhere. Kadidloi, Didloi, and then you're done to everywhere. I ran Goro Bariang, the Japan, the Huap, the Hera Lay Quayum, Goro Binardi Nan. Yeah, one part important. Mimu Kenya, naongea juu ya upendo. Watu tenda matendo pasipo upendo. One pare, kutoka Kenya, mpaka Australia, Tanzania, mpaka Asia, Sudani, mpaka Pakistani. Munataka love, kusitant, kusitant.
Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD featuring long out-of-print Pablo Casals recordings from the 1950s. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Some prized Bach recordings from the 50s, now on CD, got our classical music critic Lord Schwartz thinking about how some musical performances should not be overlooked, even if they might be considered out of style.
When I first started collecting classical records, an especially admired series was already long out of print. They were the recordings made in the early 1950s at annual music festivals in the small Catalan towns of Prague and Perpignan in France, right near the Spanish border. That's where the great Spanish cellist Pablo Casals was living, to avoid a death sentence imposed by Franco's fascist government. I remember going into the gramophone shop on Manhattan's 8th Street and seeing a used copy of one of these box sets of LPs for $300, way beyond anything I could afford. Years later, some of these recordings began to appear on CD, but many of them have remained unavailable in any form. So I'm especially glad to see three new double CD albums on the British label Pearl, all devoted to the music of Bach, played at the very first festival at Prague in 1950. Here, oboist Marcel Tabuteau and violinist Isaac Stern are conducted by Casals. These days, there seems to be only one respectable way to play Bach, in so-called historically informed performances, on instruments that were either made in the 18th century or are reproductions of those instruments. Of course, there are many excellent performances under these conditions, but Bach was a composer for whom the particular instruments didn't necessarily matter. He took pieces he or other composers wrote for one instrument and arranged them for other instruments. In one case, The Art of the Fugue, we aren't sure he had any particular instrument in mind. But however out of date a style of playing might be, it seems to me we should never overlook a great performance. The warm expressiveness, the drama, and the sublime beauty of these prod recordings, played and conducted by Casals with some of the most searching musicians of the time, should be a reminder that we mustn't allow any one style to dictate how music ought to be played. This is Casals with violinist Joseph Seghetti. There's also a spectacular 13-disc, less than half-price set on the Music and Arts label of actual live chamber music performances from Prague. More Bach, but also Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, Schubert, Schumann, and Mendelssohn, some even more ravishing than any of the commercial versions, some of unusual pieces these artists never recorded in a studio. And what a few of them lack in perfection, they make up in urgency and spontaneity.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed recordings from the Pablo Casals Festival at Prague, now on CD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the epic adventure Kingdom of Heaven from the director of Gladiator and starring Orlando Bloom on DVD tomorrow. And from the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a National Guardsman's military blog about his life in Iraq. We talk with Jason Christopher Hartley. His new memoir, Just Another Soldier, reprints his blog and explains why his commander ordered him to stop posting it. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.